We're back. We actually have successfully turned the tape.
Yes.
And we're back with respect to Dick Rowe, the interview, and Dick, you were talking about your experiences as a division director in the mid-1970s.
Okay. I wasn't quite division director when the summons came from the Hill to come up and testify on the report that the commission had submitted on the voluntary disclosure program for questionable foreign payments. It always seemed like if there was something that was troublesome or was going to be a beat up on the staff inquiry, then I would be one of the
I share that feeling. Any time there was something bad that was going to happen up on the Hill, I testify.
But I can recall when I was the associate director, a hearing by a congressman from Ohio on a tender offer in the state of Ohio for the stock of an Ohio company, and wanting to know what the commission was going to do to stop this, because it was going to be the loss of jobs and everything in Ohio. Well, you know, not much we could do about that. Another one on condominiums, where it was interesting because I'm only interested in because Carla Hills, who was Rod Hill's spouse, was the head of the office of the Department of Housing.
Mm-hmm. Hard, HUD.
HUD, and she was up there testifying. Did a much better job than I did. And there was, and then Congressman Rangel got us up there on what we were doing about South Africa. The best one was Senator Proxmire, who summoned us up there on a Saturday. I guess it was Phil Loomis and I, and I can't remember who else. And
Phil Loomis was a commissioner at this time.
No, this was when Phil was the general counsel.
He's still the general counsel.
Yeah. And I think that's right. And Secretary Blumenthal, the Secretary of the Treasury. And this was on Who Owns America, and which had been a subject of congressional hearings and some rulemaking. And look up there, there's the dais, all of these television cameras, and Senator Proxmire. And that's the only person from the other side. And he put us through a ringer, and, you know, why aren't you disclosing Who Owns America? And they wanted to go down to something like 100% ownership, had to file reports with the commission. Actually, Harvey Pitt and I had drafted rules some years before, where it's 5%.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I can't even remember the questions they asked the commission, but they asked Secretary Blumenthal, whose background was that he had been of a Jewish family in Europe, and they had fled to Asia, and then he came here, and he became very successful, and ran a very successful corporation, and then became Secretary of the Treasury. And Proxmire said, Secretary Blumenthal, if some Nazis owned part of your company, wouldn't you want to know? Blumenthal said, I wouldn't care. So, anyway. But get back to the report on questionable foreign payments. So, the commission said, you're going to go up there and you're going to testify. But you're not going to reveal, our instructions to you, you are not going to reveal the names of those companies. And we're sending Harvey Pitt, who's the general counsel, up there. He's your lawyer. Harvey's not testifying. He's your lawyer.
I see.
So we go up there in the evening, after work. We go into this room with these two lawyers whose reputation we knew very well. They once purportedly parachuted into a oil field when they were investigating the Federal Power Commission. Surprise. Anyway,
these were the two guys that were aggressive and not very good.
Yeah. Well, not that they were not very good, but they didn't sometimes understand the law or the way agents had worked. Anyway, they got us into the room.
It was just you and Harvey and the two other lawyers?
Yeah.
Up in Capitol Hill.
Up in Capitol Hill on the House side and in a conference room somewhere. And they started asking questions about the report. And, okay, here's case number one. Who is the company? But I'm not allowed to tell you that. My client, the commission, has instructed me not to tell you. And if you want the information from them, you can subpoena them.
Why was the commission concerned about the disclosure of the names of the company?
Because they had opened this up for people, for companies to come in voluntarily and reveal information to the commission, and the understanding was that this would be kept in confidence unless the commission determined to bring it forward.
So if the names were disclosed to people up on the Hill and those names got out, it would ruin the program. People wouldn't come in voluntarily.
That's absolutely correct, and our experience has been if once something gets into the hands of the staff on the Hill, it's going to be published in the Wall Street Journal the next day. I'm overstating the case, but that's generally what's happened.
As a person who came down the pike several years later in the same position, I can tell you that if you did give the House or the Senate some piece of information, the staff would leak it to the press very promptly.
Yes.
It was a very efficient market.
Well, anyway, this kept up for some time, and Harvey's sitting there smiling and not getting questions. And then these two guys say, okay, we have instructed the sergeant-at-arms to lock the doors, and you're staying here until you answer these questions.
You are staying. Was Harvey required?
No, I said Harvey could leave.
Harvey could leave.
So this went on for several hours, and then I kept giving them the same answer, and they finally gave up, and they let us go, and we go back up to the commission to report to Rod Hills, who was then the chairman. And Rod was still in his office, and he really wanted to know what happened up there. And at that time, he said, look, I'm going to appoint you director. I'm not going to appoint you acting director. I'm going to appoint you a director. So I became the director of Corps Finn that evening.
Did your experience as a first lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps help you to withstand the scrutiny of the two fellows up on Capitol Hill?
Absolutely. I mean, if you've had a drill sergeant with his face up against yours screaming at you that he's going to kill you, these two guys are locking you in a room with him. Strike no fear in your heart at all.
After being in the Army from 1969 to 1972, I can tell you nothing could be thrown at you that the Army already didn't throw at you, and in your case, the Marine Corps. So you're now a newly minted number 7 division director in terms of the history. What were your first acts? What did you want to accomplish as a division director?
I wanted to first run the best division in the commission very good division, and it already was. I mean, my predecessors had done that. But also, with my rulemaking background, I wanted to see what we could accomplish in rules in various areas. And some of those were tender offers, where we had been operating under temporary rules since 1970, I guess it was, which Alan Levinson wrote over a weekend at the instructions of the then chairman of the commission, after somebody else, I think, had tried for a while and not come up with something satisfactory. I can't remember exactly what the timing was, but going private rules.
There was a famous speech by Al Sommer at Notre Dame with respect to going private transactions in the late 1970s, and then the commission started a series of investigations. There were 17 of them and enforcement took the lion's share of the good cases. Corp Fin actually conducted several of the investigations. That was my first touch of being anything of any consequence. Was I was one of the hearing officers for the ATO American LaFrance going private transaction, which ironically Al Sommer had been the lawyer to Harry Figge, who had taken American LaFrance private less than 17 months after the initial public offering.
Well, Al didn't say in his speech that all going private was, there was some good going private and some bad.
No, but I soon found out exactly why enforcement didn't want that case and sent it to Corporation France, because there was disclosure in there that said that we may at any time buy back this 10% and take it private.
Yeah. Well, the commission, wholly apart from their enforcement activities, also held hearings on going private, which ultimately resulted in rulemaking, which was an interesting rulemaking proceeding because the commission historically had been a disclosure agency on the theory that sunlight is the best disinfectant and the like. And the staff, at least, was thinking about and discussing with the commission what I would call more substantive rules, that, for example, that there ought to be fairness, not just disclosures, the considerations of fairness, but there ought to be fairness in these proceedings. Ultimately, the commission, wiser heads of the commission prevailed, and the rules are, while they are in some instances, lawyers think that, or the clients at least, think that they're onerous rules because it's really, you know, an extensive disclosure, and the staff, as some of my colleagues would say, torture you in the comment process. But ultimately, it is a substantive rule, and disclosure is made, and the company goes private.
Just to footnote that point, 13E, the section says fraudulent, deceptive, manipulative act or practice. There was no legislative history for that in the Williams Act, and the research with respect to what Dick's talked about a concept known as equitable fraud. And under the concept of equitable fraud, fairness and the idea of the board of directors acting in an unfair manner was fraudulent under state corporation law. There was actually case law on that, and the commission did propose 13E3 the first time with an equitable fraud standard.
Right. Ultimately, that didn't get adopted.
It was finally adopted in 1979, and just to go back to the release that was 10 pages long, the release that adopted 13E3, and while you were there as division director, was 123 pages.
Yeah, and I remember that because when the commission was, after the commission had approved it, then the release has to go out. And Harvey was, Ted was the general counsel, and I was the director of division. And we wanted to get, it was sort of like the National Food Market Act, we better get that release out as fast as we can because there are some commissioners who are going to get their hands on it and it's going to change. And we did get it out as fast as we could. These days it seems like it takes the commission, for a major release, it takes them a week to 10 days to get it out after the commission has acted on it. But I don't know what internal process goes on there now.
Well, I'm chuckling because I was the special counsel in the Office of Disclosure Policy who wrote the proposing and the adapting release, and when the division director says that release goes out this afternoon, quite frankly, that release went out that afternoon. The commission meeting was in the morning, and the release went out that afternoon.
Yeah, but I think I know I was out of town. I think Harvey may have been with me or called me, but anyway, he was adamant that it had to get out. It was going to get worked on, but it didn't.
It's also one of the few releases that I worked on that Harvey actually reviewed the entire release. So, I mean, Harvey was involved in that, but your final okay was what was absolutely critical in terms of that release.
And there were other rulemaking proceedings, and here I'm probably blurring some of the things that went on when I was a director. Some that went on when I was an associate director of disclosure policy. But, for example, there were hearings on what I would call shareholder rights. The subject of some controversy these days, too.
That was Barb Leventhal, Dick Nessen, and the definition of independence, was it not?
Yeah, and what rights shareholders had under our proxy rules and other rules, I guess. But there's an interesting story there. Harold Williams was the chairman of the commission at the time, so I must have been director. The staff was running the hearings and staffing the oversight of the hearings, acting as hearing officers. And we had one hearing here in Washington, and Harold said, "I want to be on the panel that's the hearing panel." It's okay, you're the chairman, you can be on the hearing panel. And he said, "And I want it open to anybody, anybody who wants to speak there. I want it open to them, obviously first come, first serve, because we're limited." I said, "Harold, are you sure you want to do that?" And he said, "Yes, I want it open. Anybody who wants to testify, first come, first serve." And I went to, I think Ralph Ferrara was then his executive assistant. I said, "Ralph, does he really want this to happen? Anybody?" "Yes." "Okay." I said, "He's the chairman. We come to the hearing." And Harold had had a career as a corporate CEO.
So I was at Hunt and Wesson, right?
At Hunt, and perhaps some other places. But anyway, he had, as a CEO of a large public company, he had had corporate gadflies appear at his meetings and given a lot of time. And so we opened the hearings, and the first witness to testify, or the first participant to testify, is a woman named Evelyn Y. Davis, a corporate gadfly if there ever was one. And she had been one of the ones that had been a gadfly at the meetings of Hunt. And she opens up by saying, "Harold, darling." Ben Williams looks at me and says, "How did that woman get here?" I said, "Harold, you said anybody. I try to talk you out."
Yes.
Anyway.
On the tender offer rules, while you were a division director, the permanent rules went in several segments, but as a former rule writer, I can say one thing. You're responsible for 14E3. 14E3 is insider trading in the context of a tender offer. And I remember the morning that you called me into your office and you said something like, "I've been reading in Forbes magazine about how people are buying securities that are going to be the subject of a tender offer because the price of the stock of the target company is going up before the public announcement." And you looked at me and said, "I want you to write a rule on that." And could you help me with respect to it? I've always wanted to know this. As a former rule writer myself, and you being a former rule writer, how did you come up with an idea for a rule? Where did it come from, 14E3 in particular, but also generally?
Well, I don't have a precise recollection of that, but it seemed like there were abuses going on that couldn't be reached by 10b-5. Whether there was no duty to disclose or some other criteria that was necessary for 10b-5, but the people were taking advantage. And as you know, 14e-3 creates the duty of disclosure or not trading, because it says that once you know that there's going to be a tender offer, you can't trade. And that was sort of the idea. I probably also wanted to get a jump on the Division of Enforcement. I think it was probably better to do the first draft than to have the Division of Enforcement. Division of Enforcement always had a different outlook on things. And rightfully so, because of what they saw. They see the worst in people, and Corfin sees, for the most part, the best in people. And they would take positions that would certainly assist them in their enforcement cases, but make it very difficult for others to comply with the law, or if they had to comply with the law, very expensive and complex ways of going about it. So that may have been another reason.
When the drafts of this release were going up, Phil Loomis was a commissioner, and he changed the word "create a duty" to "affirmed a duty." And also, this rule was being proposed and adopted long in advance of Chiarella. Chiarella was really unknown to the staff at the time, so the idea of this rule being a response to Chiarella was really a misnomer. But we did steal a march on enforcement. Enforcement was pleasantly surprised with 14.3, and unlike the 13D rules, where they were really involved in the process of proposing and adopting, on 14.3, basically the entire rulemaking proceeding happened outside of enforcement. So your strategy worked, Mr. Rowe.
Well, you mentioned 13D. That was an experience with enforcement, and they wanted to get behind ownership to a much greater degree than was practical. And as I had mentioned before, there had been bills pending in Congress that would go down to the fractions of a percentage of stock had to be, holders had to be reported, which just wasn't practical, and the commission couldn't have handled it in those days. They didn't have a computer system that would have been able to handle it. I don't know if they do today, but there are instances where there are rules on the books that are there because enforcement wants to be able to, or at least thinks they want to be able to check up on things. And Regulation D and Form D is a perfect example of that. At one point, there was a move afoot to do away with the filing of the Form D, assuming that could be done without causing too much consternation in the states with their blue sky uniform filing. But enforcement resisted that. I don't know that they used or even look at Form Ds, but they insisted that it had to be filed. Now, we had there's a Rule 701, which is for offers and sales to employees of private companies. For many years, there was a form that had to be filed to avail yourself of the exemption under that rule. But the commission was wiser in those days, or wise in adopting that rule, because they made it a temporary rule with an automatic sunset, and nobody was interested enough to try to undo the sunset.
Also, while you were division director, S-16, a short form registration statement started to come in, and the whole concepts of the integrated disclosure system started to burble up, and people started to talk about integration. Could you give us a little bit of picture from your perspective on the beginnings of shelf registration and S-16 and what your thought process was?
Well, for some time there had been thought that disclosure required, and we're talking now about 33 Act registration statements, ought to be somewhat less for what I'll call seasoned companies. You can define seasoned companies in a number of different ways, but you know, the number of years they've been reporting, what their market cap is, but that there are certain companies that because they're well known, because they're filing reports under the Exchange Act periodically, the disclosure under the 33 Act and registration ought to be somewhat less. And the first such form, I think, was called S7. I can't remember now, but it wasn't much less. The management information was not required, but just about everything else. Very extensive discussion of the business. And
if I remember correctly, it was S7 for equity and S9 for investment grade, what became investment grade debt.
That's right.
That was my first registration statement that I reviewed when I was an examiner in branch number 2, was an S9.
But going back to the time I was Frank Weed's legal assistant, Frank worked on a report. Ostensibly, he was assigned the task because Manny Cohen wanted to get him out of his hair, although Manny didn't have any hair to get out of. And Frank did what's become known as the Wheat Report, which had a number of recommendations, the predecessor of Rule 144, but Frank also recommended that there be quarterly reports, which up until then there had been a semi-annual report, but it didn't have much information in it, and that there be beefed up 34 Act disclosure in general. And that was one of the underpinnings of allowing resales of restricted securities, because there was information available to the marketplace about the issuer. So that sort of underlay that if the company is seasoned enough, its disclosure has been out there enough, there are many, many more transactions in the marketplace that rely on the 34 Act disclosures than there are that rely on the 33 Act disclosure. Why shouldn't we loosen up 33 Act? And the commission generally does things in increments, and S16, which was a, best of my recollection, at least first was a short, what I call a short-form registration statement, relying on incorporation by reference of the 34 Act reports, but available only for secondary transactions, resales of restricted securities. There was also a Form S8 for offers to employees, where you, again, you don't need a full-blown registration statement. And then there was Al Sommer, after he left the commission, headed up a disclosure study, which was staffed, although the study was outside people, including Warren Buffett and some others. It was staffed internally at the commission. Mickey Beach, who's head of the Office of Disclosure Policy mm-hmm. at the time, and others at the commission worked very closely with Al and his staff.
She subsequently took your job as Associate Director for Disclosure Policy
right.
when you became Division Director.
Right. And quite frankly, I was trying to keep one step ahead of the committee. I mean, I obviously had staff there that knew what was going on, and I could anticipate where they were coming from and saw no reason to wait. And so we put forth some of our recommendations early on, but the report came out. I left the commission. Ed Green succeeded me,
mm-hmm.
and within a few years, we had what today is the integrated disclosure system, relying on the 34 Act reports for seasoned companies. But the seeds were sown before that, and Al Sommer and his study get a lot of credit for that.
The period,
and Frank Wheat's report.
The period, victory of a thousand fathers, defeat as an orphan. This period in the late 1970s, though, was really a very important period in terms of things like the birth of SK, the birth of short form registration. The whole groundwork, if you will, the framework for a lot of what happened from 1980 on was sort of not just built but developed during that time. I mean, What about SK? Where did SK come from your perspective, and what did you want to accomplish by SK?
Well,
because I was always taught that, you know, the S came from the 33 Act, the K came from the 33.
And I gave you an example of one. But basically, a couple of things. One, we thought that the commission could accomplish, if it wanted to, through rulemaking, quite a bit of what the code was substantively trying to do. And that was even before the commission had broad exemptive authority. And they had done that in a number of cases, by interpretation, granted, but they could do it. That was number one. Number two, we were very concerned that if you wrote, although there were problems in interpreting various provisions of these statutes,